Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I'm delighted to welcome you to Emerge Australia's 2025 podcast series, in which I speak to a range of individuals, patients, clinicians, and researchers impacted by and associated with ME/CFS and long COVID. I acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we meet and pay my respects to elders past, present, those emerging, and listening to this podcast. We are once again using the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, timeless lyrics and music in which we are transformed to a place where we dare to imagine a world where there is no greed or hunger, no war, where we have a brotherhood of man. Maybe a world without discrimination or stigma, a world where there is a cure for ME/CFS, where the voices of those suffering invisibly are listened to, seen and heard, where we imagine all the people. Today, I'm delighted to introduce you to Miss Sarah Visor. In her early 40s, Sarah made the difficult decision to step away from a promising 20-year corporate career after experiencing severe burnout. What she didn't know was her condition was a direct result of not being able to manage the early warning signs of stress. This led to full-blown ME/CFS, a life-altering condition she still navigates today. Sarah is a Brisbane-based author, speaker, and certified executive coach. Through her personal journey, she has embraced a life that values balance, self-awareness, and resilience. Sarah inspires others by sharing actionable insights and practical strategies for managing fatigue. Her new book, Too Tired to Think, is an intersection of hope and reality for those who battle long-term fatigue and their carers. Sarah has lived through it all, from being mostly housebound and feeling let down by her body to now functioning well despite daily fatigue. It's great to welcome Sarah Visor to our Emerge Australia podcast. Welcome, Sarah, and hello.
Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for having me on.
So perhaps let's just start at the beginning of your journey with ME/CFS. Tell us a bit about your life, particularly your life prior to July 2017.
Sure. Yeah, I think July 2017 seems to be a real pivotal point for me. And before then, I was quite an adventurous, high energy, excitable, hardworking type of person. So as you said, I'd had 20 years in a corporate career and I absolutely loved working. And that was probably a huge chunk of my life up to life that date. Sorry, Anne. Just going to step back and center.
Careful.
Yeah, so prior to July 17, I would say that I had lived life with so much energy and enthusiasm. I was a really adventurous person. I loved to travel. I'd been working on my career for 20 years, and I found myself in an amazing corporate job. I was in change management, and I was a leader helping people through navigate these intense cultural change projects. And whilst I loved the work that I was doing, what I found in that lead up to July 2017 was I wasn't really handling life in the same way I had in the previous years. And I look back now and I can see that I'd just been having so much stress that had come onto my life, and it had just been getting on top of me, and had been getting on top of me for probably for quite a few years before I really started to take notice. And so it was around Christmas in 2016 when I really felt like my mind and my body started to fail. And I started feeling lots of different symptoms, like I was waking up crying. I was finding that all I could do was go to work, come home, go to bed, just try and get through to the next day when I was going to go to work again. I was then finding that I just didn't have the same energy that I would have normally put into friends and family and life around me. And my whole life had come down to work, home, just try and recover. So July 2017 was a pivotal time in that I took 2 week holiday from my job. And at that time, he said, "Sarah, you're really burnt out and you need a holiday." So I thought 2 weeks was going to cut it, but no, 2 weeks was not going to be enough. I found that after the 2 weeks, I was absolutely exhausted. I had all of what we would say are typical burnout symptoms that people in the corporate world go through, the exhaustion, the brain fog, the inability to hold a thought in my head, the whole, you feel very crushed, your self-esteem suffers, and I just couldn't stomach the thought of life in the same way that I used to. Everything felt really overwhelming. So yeah, I'd say 2017 was a really pivotal time for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a shock to your system when things that you could do and the way you have been living all of a sudden changes, and you don't necessarily understand why it's changing, but something's changing in your body that that you don't understand. And I suspect that there aren't many medical reasons given for that change. So did you feel a bit sort of lost and thinking, well, what's happening to me? Did that come into your thinking at the time?
Absolutely. I think you nailed it. It's so confusing, and the medical industry just didn't have that many answers. So I had a GP that I'd been seeing for quite a while. And as I said, I'd had a psychologist who was the one who said, "This is burnout." But what happened was the GP said, "Look, you've got anxiety and you're depressed," which is confusing because I hadn't really had anxiety or been depressed in my previous life. But I'm like, "All right, you know best." And he said, "You should go on this medication," which I tried for a really short period of time and found it was just made things 10 times worse. And it's like that chicken and egg, like, I think I was very anxious and feeling a lot of grief and confusion and all of those, but was it because my body was failing? Like, or did that cause my body to fail? It's like, which comes first? I think it's a rightful reaction that you would feel anxious and depressed when things start to happen and no one can tell you why. And so it wasn't a good decision, and I got off the medication as soon as possible. But then I was left with this big void of, well, what is wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
And we know with burnout, it's they will often say it's all in your head. It's something, you're stressed. You need to go sort yourself out and then come back to us and, when you feel better. And that might be right for some people. And for me, I guess it took me a couple of years of working through what is going on mentally. But physically, that exhaustion, the brain fog, the physical things that I felt just never resolved.
So can I ask you, you're a very high-functioning, high-performing executive. Would you have regarded yourself as a perfectionist at the time?
Look, I look back now, and this is what I have a coaching business now, when I work with people who are heading towards burnout. And that is something absolutely we have in common. So that's a good pickup. Yes, I had high standards. I was highly conscientious. I never wanted to let people down. I was a bit of a people pleaser. Probably still am a little bit today, I can say. So I would put people ahead of my own needs. I also was allergic to letting anyone down. So I found I would always go that extra mile, very hardworking, whether it suited me or not. And absolutely, a lot of those traits are the ones that often lead to burnout and lead to those high levels of stress that we feel.
Yeah, and I ask that because, I can only imagine the sense of loss, and we'll talk about grief later on, the sense of loss and disappointment that you'd have in yourself not being able to achieve at the same level as you have in the past, and what the issues that would have caused you, just emotionally, if in no other way.
Yeah, it's a really good observation. And it's, one thing that I know with ME/CFS, and probably with anything that's long-term, any long-term illness, or even just things like changes, transitions in life or aging, is that it can cut to that core sense of your own identity.
Yeah.
And there was a point that I know I looked in the mirror and I just didn't recognize the person that was there standing in front of me. Because I wasn't able to work, and I'd put so many of my eggs in that work basket, the identity basket. And I used to love doing things like I was a rock climber. I loved climbing mountains. I loved that feeling of the escape, of being outside, of being active, of being social. I had a lot of energy. And all of a sudden, that was not who I was anymore. I was someone who found it really hard to get out of bed, let alone try to work. One thing I had 3 degrees before I was 30. It's just, I just love learning. I love using my mind. And I was just so foggy. I couldn't keep a thought in my head. I started missing appointments because I'd write the time down wrong, just little things like that. And that was one of the hardest things in those early years of going, well, if I'm not this corporate person who, as you're saying, is high achieving, who loves traveling, who does all these big adventures, then who am I?
Okay, so that sort of talks a little bit about the impact of some of the changes that occurred since 2017. But I guess, what were the steps that you had to take at that time? What happened? How did you deal with that? What did you do with that? Because what we know is that so many people with ME/CFS who are not diagnosed, who find it very difficult to get a doctor, a GP who understands them, because they're primarily gaslit by their GPs. How did you deal with all of that to start moving forward?
Well, okay, so I'll take you back. So it was around the beginning of 2018. So I'd been in this state for 6 months and I started seeing an integrative doctor. And she held a lot of hope for me. She was the person who put the words around ME/CFS. And she held on, like she gave me this sense that recovery was possible and I was going to be someone who was going to recover really quickly. But what I had to do was I had to buy these 15 really expensive supplements that they sold in their practice, which I did, of course. I did everything I could at that time to feel like I was going to recover. And so I saw her for over a year and I did everything she asked of me. And it was always like she was always pressing me, you know, are you feeling better? And I'd try and dredge up something to say, but quite honestly, I wasn't feeling any better. It was like, if anything, I was getting worse. And I remember coming into her office one day and I broke down in front of her and I said, look, I just feel awful. And I remember her looking at me like I was nothing. Like she just looked disappointed for herself. And I know that later on, she wrote a report about me and she put in the report that she thought that I was putting it on.
Are you kidding?
And it was crushed. I was crushed. And as you can imagine, if I did find it hard to trust people in the medical industry a little bit after that. But she also did me a kind of favor because that's when I started to realize that not all doctors are created equal, not all medical professionals, not all people are created equal. And I realized that I needed somebody good in my corner, and I wasn't going to put up with that. And not only just the medical industry, I needed good people in my corner in all aspects of life. So that was a really important point of realization. Now, after that, I can't say it was an easy journey. And the other thing that people might not understand was I was just so affected that to actually attend that one appointment with that integrative doctor, it took so much of my resources, my time, my energy, and my money. And that might have been the only thing that I did that week was to
Yeah.
be able to attend that session. So when it's disappointing, it's more than just one appointment's disappointing. That's my whole week's work has just been down the drain. And I must say, I started seeing a couple of different doctors in my local area. I had one who didn't even believe chronic fatigue existed. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you think it is then? And he said, well, it's just undiagnosed anxiety and depression, pretty much like that first doctor that I'd had. And so you kind of just, you know, you need a lot of resilience at that time when you don't have a lot of resilience and you don't have a lot of energy. It's asking a lot of you when you have these interactions. Now, luckily for me, I did then set up a time with a doctor. And what I would do is I'd go in with something different just and sound them out around chronic fatigue just to see if they even believed in it to start with. And I was lucky enough to find a doctor, and he was an older man who had had his own practice for a long time. And he'd seen quite a few people like me go through his practice. And he said something really important to me that I'll never forget. And I'm so grateful to him. He said, Sarah, you know, some people will have chronic fatigue for 20 years or
Yes.
more, ME/CFS for 20 years or more. But that's not going to be you because I can see that spark in you that you really want to try some different things. And I'm willing to try some different things with you. And having someone like that in my corner, that's when I realized that that's what I really had been missing. I'd needed that kindness, that person who was willing to really try some different things for me to go the whole journey without, I guess, putting li these like I guess without saying to me like you should be better in this certain time period because no one can tell you when you're going to feel better. It's just not possible. And with his help, that just that one little bit of support some of the things we tried didn't really work, but that feeling of support, that was invaluable to me.
So that's really interesting in listening carefully to what you're saying and trying to marry that into what I've heard others say. It seems to me that what's really important is there are a couple of things that are really important. Having the tenacity to keep investigating and going to different people when some clinicians completely gaslight you, don't believe you and don't believe in you. So tenacity is something that really helps, because it's that thing that says, I'm going to keep going until I find a bloody answer. Right? So tenacity is one thing, but the important thing that you've also mentioned there is finding a clinician who believes in you, not just believes your story, but believes in you, and then somehow that also gives you the drive to, okay, let's keep going for another day. Because I have in my head the conversations of so many people who have experienced what you've experienced, but have stopped at the point where the doctor has said, well, I really can't do any more for you, you need to go home and rest. And they go home and rest for years because they don't believe there's anyone out there that can help them. And what I'm hearing from you is that you, and that's not to say that others are not tenacious, but you wouldn't accept that the one or two doctors you went to that gave you no hope, you didn't accept that that was going to happen with everyone, so you kept going. Is that a fair estimation?
I would say absolutely, but I would also recognize that it took so much from me, and it would take so much from the people who are listening to this to find that tenacity and to find that resilience at a time like they're kicking you when you're already down. And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
There was probably many times in there that I just went home and went, right, this is my life now then. Like, it's, do you know what I mean? It's I wasn't, I don't want to make it sound like, all right, I just kept going from person to person. It
no,
this
no,
was a few
no.
years.
What would you say to those people? Because I think you've got a couple of gems in there that I'd like to uncover for exactly that target audience, you know, because I can imagine you would have come home and thought, I'm giving up. This is too much. This is my life. No one's going to help. Nothing's going to help. What's your message to the others that are in that situation right now?
Yeah. Okay. So, look, it is so hard. And it's not just the medical community either. Like, we could broaden that out to say it's everyone in your life. It's so hard when you have something that's so long term. And, you know, I've heard you talk about this so many times. It's kind of almost that invisible, it's unseen, it's hidden. It's hard to explain to, it's hard to understand for yourself, let alone try and explain it to somebody else. So finding the support you need, not just the medical support, but just having that sense of my family and my friends get me, and I've got people in my life that I can rely on, that can be one of the hardest things as well, because people can find it very hard to support someone long term. It's a lot easier when we've got something physical, like if you've got a broken bone, or if you've got something, we all know, you know, someone has cancer, there's a way that they go through a treatment protocol. And I've said in my book, you know, with these types of conditions, people will turn up, they'll offer support, they'll cook you a meal, they'll do all these things for you. But with something that's so hidden and unseen, it can be so hard to feel like people actually get you and not just judge you for what you feel like you've become. So I acknowledge that that is such a hard thing, and it's you've got to keep that tenacity. Is right, it's that tenacity to keep searching for an answer for yourself first of all, so then you can explain it to everyone else around you. It just costs so much energy.
That's right, your battery's running on empty all the time.
Yeah, and it's like, where do I put my precious energy? Like, having this conversation over and over with someone, no, I'm not demotivated, no, I'm not lazy, I'm just really fatigued. And then they might say, oh, I get tired too. It's like, well, actually, you don't really understand what I'm feeling. It's so hard. It's like
I get the that kind of response from people. They say, oh yeah, well, look, I'm really tired, my job's been really hard today. No, it's not the same. And you know what, that kind of response totally kills discussion, because when you get that kind of response from someone, they go, oh, what's the point? They don't get it.
Exactly. And then that's a sinking feeling. It's like, oh, I'm alone in this.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go to that, because one of the things that you've done, which is amazing, is you've written this fabulous book called Too Tired to Think. And what a great title. I don't have ME/CFS, but sometimes I am too tired to think, and I don't think at all. Goodness knows what goes on in that time. But anyway, but it's very, very specific as far as you're concerned here. In your book, you talk about dark times and not so dark times. Can you take us through some of those areas that you've discussed in your book and how they impacted you?
Yeah, no, thank you. I say a couple of times in the book, it could almost be called too tired to rest, because sometimes even just laying in my bed, I'm too tired to even just do that. But too tired to think is what I settled on. Dark times. Oh, look, there's been so many dark times, and it's a cycle that I still have days where I feel that sense of frustration. I'll take you back to one time I remember, and I feel like this is just written on my soul. It was New Year's Eve on 2018, going into 2019. And I was just too tired, of course, to go out. I'd been invited, but all I could do was stay at home. It's with my dog, thank goodness, my little pup. But I just felt, I was just laying on my bed going, I'm so exhausted. And I could hear life going on around me. And it just felt like every single person in the world was living their life except for me. I was stuck here in this prison of my own bedroom. And I remember just laying there and that feeling, I was just being crushed by these feelings. I was angry, and then I was like, I was sad. I felt shame. And then I had this crushing sense of loneliness. The loneliness, it was just such a physical thing for me. I felt it in the back of my throat. I was just so lonely at that time. And so what I often do is I write when I have the energy for it. So at that time, what I did was I pulled out my journal to just try and ease some of the suffering. I was really suffering at that time. And I started writing. I'm just writing about my experience. And it's almost like you have an out-of-body look at what you're writing, and you go, wow, look at these words. Look at all the suffering that I was just pouring onto this piece of paper. And I just felt the toxicity of the thoughts. I could just see how far I'd sunk, and it scared me. It really scared me, because it didn't feel like myself. It didn't feel like they were my words. I didn't understand what was happening. But what I started to realize was I was suffering physically, but emotionally I was suffering even more. And we know that ME/CFS is it's a physical thing, but I also know that what I feel emotionally, those dark thoughts or those things that I'm starting to feel, they really impact on my physical state. So every time I'm sinking into these dark emotions and feeling that loneliness, I'm actually feeling the physical side even more. It's an absolute trigger for me. And it started to be this growing realization that, you know, I could start to change the way that I was thinking. And it's hard to explain because it's not like I don't have a real reason to feel these things. But what is the point of feeling those things if it's going to make me feel even worse? And it was a real turning point for myself to know, well, I can control how I feel. And I started writing. And when I write, I that's how I express my emotions and start to get some meaning out of it. And I know from that time I started going, well, you know, maybe for this next year coming, and New Year's Eve is always a great time to set a new intention for the year. Maybe for this, you know, for the next month or so, I might look at what I can be doing rather than what I can't be doing. And I just started writing some nice things, and I've got this record of it, so I know exactly how I was feeling at the time. And that was the start of, I think, really my mindset journey of trying to go, all right, well, you know, it's okay if I feel these dark times and these darker emotions. But what I've been working on is getting myself out of it quicker, not just sitting in the emotion, not just allowing it. It became something that I used to try and protect my energy. It's like I have limited energy here, and if I'm going to sit in these emotions, it's just going to trigger me, and I need to protect my energy a little bit better than that, and started monitoring myself. I still feel, to this day, I still feel these emotions. I still feel loneliness. I still feel frustration. I've just got a lot better at pulling myself out of it. And sometimes I just can have a night and go, well, you know, you don't feel great tonight. And then I reset the next day.
So what, I mean, there's just so much to unpack in what you've just said, because I think everybody, you know, that visual that you created of lying in bed and hearing life happening and you're not part of it, I think that's just such an amazing visual. I'd love to create that because I can see it in my mind. I can see what that would look like and feel like. So you talk about, you know, trying to get yourself out of it quicker. What do you say to yourself when you're in that space?
It's, you know, it's a bit of a pathway that I've developed in my mind, I guess. It's the first step for me is always just allowing myself to feel that way and to acknowledge it in myself and go, you know what, this is okay. I am going through something really hard and I'm still going through it now, not as bad as I was there and at all, but I still have life effects. It's okay. But then something else kicks into place that says, you know, my energy is my number one priority. I say health is my number one priority, and I equate my health and my energy together there. And this is my number one priority. And I protect it with like a bit of a fierceness. And the fact that, you know, if I allow these negative emotions to leech away at that energy, I'm allowing that. And that's not acceptable for me because I've just got so many other things I want to put my energy into. And so I guess it just became a point of I just didn't want to accept that in myself. But, you know, there are times when I feel that way and that's okay. And what I find is like everything feels better in the morning. So if I have a bad day, and so I've, like, one of the things that I talk about in my book is I never give up on love. I met my partner Demian 2 years into my chronic fatigue journey, and at that time I'd ask him so many times, I'm like, why do you want to be with me? I'm tired. so tired, but there's something. Demian saw the energy within me. He saw the He's always been able to see the person that I am, which is such a gift. And so I know now I have a way of, like, I just tell Demian, oh, I'm not feeling so great. And just by telling him, and I think for anyone listening, if you don't have a partner or you don't have someone you can just tell your dog, or you can tell a teddy bear, or you can tell someone, or you could write it out. It's just that acknowledgement of, I'm going through something at the moment, but for me, I don't want to let myself sit in that for too long, because I know the effect it will have on my energy, and I've just got other things I want to do with my energy. And I find that the overnight reset is often just what I need. So I go, I'm just going to put myself to bed and I'm going to assess it again in the morning. Try not to judge it too much. I think that's maybe been a real, that was probably the real switch that I was able to make at that time.
So, you've triggered in me a thought that takes me back quite a long way in things that I've studied and learned, and that has to do with your own personal self-talk. What do you say to yourself? What do you what because even I would think having that recognition that says everything will be better in the morning. What there will be some pre-thinking that goes on in your mind that helps to guide what you do. And how do you protect your mind from taking you down another path?
It's, so one thing that no one ever tells you, and that I've outlined in my book, is, and I call it the marathon of improvement and recovery. And I've outlined four different stages that I think I can see commonality of people go through. And so people going through these different stages, but what people never talk about is that if when you are starting to feel a little bit better and starting to get more function, or even just when you're in the heart of chronic fatigue, it's never just one straight line of experience. You're never always all down or always all up. And when you start to feel a bit better, it's never just a straight line of improvement. What I found was I go up and down. And it's like, so you have the highs where you start to get just that little smidge of energy and you start to feel a little bit excited and you celebrate and you probably overcommit and do too much. And then it's then a trough again. You go back down again, and you get post-exertional malaise, PEM, and you start to feel really terrible again. But then after a time, for me, I started to come back up again, and it was just this constant wave of ups and downs, ups and downs.
Closer.
And it really took Demian to notice that. And I find it hard when I'm in that down period. I find it hard to maintain perspective. And when I'm in the up period, I just do way too much. I overschedule, even now.
Being the perfectionist, the Sarah who's striving, etc. It's
Just got so much, well, it's just so
way
much I want to do. It's like so much life to live. But it's maintaining perspective in those downtimes is the important part. So what do I say to myself? It's a recognition that I'm just in a down period at the moment, but I need to hold true that I will come up again at some point. Don't know when, don't know anything. All I can do is control this at this point in time. This is my current reality. And I guess it the one thing that chronic that ME/CFS has changed in my world is I now will wake up every day and I'll do an assessment of what can I do today. It's a little bit hard when you've got commitments, and I do make commitments, but the way I schedule my weeks and my months and what I can do in a year is very structured around where I am at that time and what I think I can do, what I can commit to, knowing that I need to be really careful if I do too much one day. I might pay a price the next day or the day after or whatever, and I need to have that buffer time built into my diary. So it's this whole experience has really changed the way I think, and I think it's changed the way I think for the better. And I would say that it's this, and it's, you know, we call it pacing, right? It's pacing is the fundamentals,
pacing into it. Yep.
Yeah, it's the fundamentals of the lifestyle that we lead is this pacing. But it's something that I think that everyone can, I know that I should have probably been doing more of this in my earlier life. I might not have had so like led to what it did, but that's okay.
It is what it is. So, and we'll talk about pacing in a moment, but in your book, you talk about discovering your new normal as part of your framework to recovery. Can you take us through your thinking on what I consider this critical aspect? And I suspect rigorous pacing comes into that framework.
Absolutely. Well, so what I found when I was writing this book and trying to communicate my whole experience and the experience of everyone around me that I'd been researching, I really do believe that recovery is possible, but I also think as an endpoint, it's such a hard thing to aspire to. Like, what is recovery? Will I ever get back to the point that I was before July 2017? I don't know. Do I want to get back to that point? No. The answer, I know 100%, the answer is no. My life has changed. My outlook has changed. And in so many ways, it's changed for the better. I could have probably done without the fatigue, but it really has been a catalyst for so many wonderful things in life. And so that's what I wanted to convey, was this whole idea of you either recovered or not. It's so harsh and it's so hard. And I don't know if we even can measure that. But my new normal is, for me, a lot of an easier way to look at things. And so for me, what my new normal means is I still use pacing every day. And as I said before a little bit, I, you know, will look at my week, I will look at my month carefully, and I will manage my time. It's now an inbuilt part of what I do. I will probably only do one big social event each week. Exercise, I walk my dogs every day, and I can do a swim, I can go do a yoga class, and I schedule them in first. But some days I can't do that, and that's okay. I just have to understand that. I can work in the mornings, and I've got consistent energy most mornings now, which was an absolute gift when that started happening. So I know that I can be, that conscientious side of me gives a bit of a tick going, yes, I can commit to people. I can have a business. I can coach clients. I can do things. That's what I did all my writing for my book, was in the mornings, because I have more consistent energy now. So my new normal is this way of life that I've built up. It's not, you wouldn't say that's, you've recovered from chronic. You wouldn't say, might just want to make a note of that, Jane, sorry. You wouldn't say that I've recovered from ME/CFS, but I have got to the point where my life is happy. I'm productive. I feel like, you know, I've hit a good stride. I'm contributing to the world. And through all these different things that I've learned over the years, I'm now managing the fatigue when it does happen.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I think there are so many important issues that you've highlighted. You are a doer, and therefore you've got an attitude of, I want to do something about this, or I'm going to try to do something about it. And I think that attitude certainly helps. It feels to me as though that kind of attitude really helps. And so I just want to move on to talking about your inclusion of the grief cycle in the book, and I'm very pleased that you've done that, because it's my experience from a professional perspective, but also from a personal perspective as someone who has experienced grief and loss, not as a result of ME/CFS, but as a result of other things occurring in my life, that developing an understanding of your emotional reactions within the framework of a grief cycle is really helpful and can improve the way you cope. Can you talk a little bit about the grief cycle that you outline, which is, you know, part of the framework of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and how that has helped you?
Yeah, okay, no problem. It's such a great model, that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross model, the grief cycle. So for people who might not know about it, it's where we go up and down with all these different, she goes through stages of grief, and she noticed it was consistent with people who she was working with in an aged home and who were approaching death. So what I've found in my experience was so typical of the grief cycle. So some of the stages you go through are things like anger, denial. You might say, oh, look, I'm not, you know, it's fine, I'm not that tired, it's okay. Bargaining, oh, look, if I can just go to this one event, then I'm happy just to rest for the rest of the week, but please just let me go to this one thing, it's really important.
Or the why me.
The why me's, the sadness, the grief. It's like, oh, I'm never going to get better, this is so terrible. And then maybe a flash of what they call acceptance. And that's kind of, it's not an endpoint acceptance. But it's something that she's put in there. And she said, well, a certain point, you just get sick of fighting it and you just go, oh, well, this is what it is. And then you might be thrown straight back into anger again. Like, why me? What's going on here? And it's so normal to have this range of emotions. And we're talking, ME/CFS is something that happens for most people over not just months, but even over years. And of course, you're just going to go through that. The marathon nature of dealing with a condition like this is one of the hardest things. Certainly the hardest thing I've ever had to go through. So it's very normal to cycle through these different emotions. And I think it's back there when I was, you know, lying in my bed on that New Year's Eve, just going, I need to find a way of accepting that I'm going to feel these different feelings and allow myself to have these feelings, because fighting them is energy expensive. And I call myself a human barometer. I know when something is energy expensive. And, you know, like we can say that the triggers for post-exertional malaise are physical, everything that we do physically on a daily basis. But we also know that mentally and emotionally, they also trigger PEM in people. And for me, it's especially the emotional side. It really just wipes me out. And I don't like that feeling anymore, and I don't want to have that feeling anymore. So that acceptance is something that I aspire to, knowing that I sometimes need to go through the stages. Now, I know for acceptance it can be hard, because you might feel like you're giving in. You're just giving up and saying, all right, why, you know, why would you give up on yourself? But it's not. True acceptance is not giving up. True acceptance is just, this is what's happening to me in this life. And, you know, it's up to me to find the best way forward. It's not fair. It's not great. It's terrible, and all these different things. But the agency that I feel is I can control my emotions to some extent. And then another researcher came up with a sixth stage of the Kubler-Ross model. And that was meaning. And I feel like, you know, I couldn't get to that stage at the beginning. If you'd have said, what's the meaning in this in the first couple of years, I might have smacked you. But definitely by writing a book and doing all these different things, it's my way of finding meaning, of being able to move through and find the meaning out of this whole experience.
That's amazing. I think that everybody would relate so well to what you've just outlined. Sort of finally, can you outline for our listeners, because you've done it so well in your book, and I'll talk about your book in a second, what you see as the keys to improvement? What are the keys that you see have A helped you that might be beneficial for our listeners to consider?
Yep. All right, no problem. Okay. From a purely practical sense, I feel that there's no better lesson that I've learned from this whole experience than the whole pacing side of life. And I feel that this is a lesson that everyone can probably benefit from. So I say, like, learn to love pacing and become a pacing pro. it's just such a great skill. So for me, practically, pacing means that I keep a physical diary on my desk as well as the one that I have on my computer, because then I can see at a glance what my week will hold. And I use different colors to indicate different types of activities. So social, I have as pink. Admin, I have as orange. Physical is green, work is blue. And what I'm looking for when I look at my week, the pacing now, is do I have anything social? Because that's the first thing that can drop off. And that's the thing that really gives me a lot of a lot of energy and a lot of, like, it takes a lot from me, but it gives me a lot as well. And then I schedule everything else around it, being really aware that I may or may not be able to do some of the things that I've scheduled for that week. So I said, being a human barometer now, I just feel every morning, how is it today? What can I do? What's going to be achievable? Knowing that there are some things that I don't want to let people down. Just keep in mind, I'm at probably the far end of the recovery continuum. For so many people, their idea of pacing might be that they were able to do that one appointment a week. That's their level of activity, understanding that we've got all these different levels of what we can be doing. The second thing that I would say is you need someone in your corner, and you need to find that one medical, the primary care person. I call it the primary care doctor. In our society, it's usually a doctor who can just be that central point of contact for you, and can, as we were talking about before, someone who believes in you, who's willing to go the distance. In my book, I call them finding gems, and I've given a criteria of what a gem would look like. I found that so important to have that one person, and then I can try all these different types of things around it. So this one person put me on a medication, low dose naltrexone, and so then if I go to some other, like, types of people, if I go, they can make sure that nothing that I'm on is going to interact with any of the medications. I've tried so many different, I've tried every therapy I can possibly think of over the years, some good, some bad. But having that one person in your corner can then help you kind of, like, understand what is it, what are all the things that you want to try, and how might that work. The people you have in your life are so important. And I know that we sometimes, like, we live with people and we don't often have the chance to impact that sometimes. But trying, for me, it was, I think, a turning point to be able to really put in words what I was going through, and to give it the best try to explain to the people around me what I was experiencing. To put some boundaries in place to go, look, I'm going to be a maybe for that event, because it's going to depend on what I'm feeling at the time. Some people came with me on this journey, some people didn't. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. but never give up on love. I was single when in July 2017, I was single, which was, part of that whole loneliness. But I did meet my partner that I have now, and he can see that energy that shines in me. He saw the true me from the beginning. And that's the type of person that I really needed in my life. And I didn't even know I needed him until I met him. The other person, you might say person, that made the biggest impact for me is my pup, Oliver. And, there was a couple of years there where I couldn't really be around a lot of people. I just didn't have the energy. I didn't have the words to explain it to people. But my pup was just, he was always there for me. And he always wanted to go outside. He loved life. It's kind of like, it's almost infectious, some of that joy that he brought. I know I'm going through a lot of things here. I think that sense of joy, those moments of joy, that is so important. When we're feeling this weight that comes at the beginning of this type of illness, or even like as we're going through the years, it can be easy to lose sight of the beautiful parts of life. So I try and bring the outside in. I have pot plants in my room. I can see the trees through my window. I go sit outside for 10 minutes at a time, even just patting Oliver. I sometimes can feel that. I can feel like I feel the heat and the sunlight on his fur. We go for little walks, and I've learned to just enjoy the nature that's around me. Finding those little moments of joy has been so important. And then I guess one last big one that I talk through in the book is being your own hero. That was one thing that really changed things for me, was not looking for that outside validation, not needing to explain what I was going through to anyone anymore, just focusing on myself, just starting. And it took me a few years to get to this point of feeling more comfort in that what I was going through was hard and I was doing the best I can. And I think it was probably what we spoke to earlier. And, when I said I looked in the mirror and I just did not recognize that person that I saw. What I did was I think I had to rebuild that image. And it took a long time. It's not like that's not an easy thing to do. But I started liking the image that I saw back, and I started owning the journey and not judging myself so harshly.
Look, Sarah, there's incredible wisdom behind everything that you're saying. And, there's quite a lot of heartache, despite the fact that you're a really, positive, engaging individual. I can see that to get to the stage that you've got to now has taken a lot of courage, a lot of being very honest and leveling with yourself. You've put some strategies in place that have allowed you to find that joy within what is an imperfect body, what is an imperfect world. But you've found, as you say, those little gems, and you've embraced a life that, as we said in the introduction, actually values balance. I love your different colours that you put in your diary, and that you say, the most important one is your spare time. That demonstrates that you are looking to balance out the must-haves with pacing, rest, time to pat your pup, time with your partner. And that self-awareness that you've developed in this journey is just a demonstration of the amazing resilience that you've built, that I believe is totally inspirational to other people. And so I just want to say that I would really encourage people listening to you speak and hearing your podcast today to reach out to Sarah. Sarah has a website. It's www.sarahvizer.com, and there's a / too tired to think. I'd really encourage you to reach out and buy the book. You may not be able to do all the things that Sarah outlines in her book, but I'd like to encourage you to look at some of the strategies there and give them a go. They may not work the first time, and you might only find one little gem in the book that relates to you. But I think this book is a gem. Too Tired to Think is a bit of a manual of all the things you can try, develop an understanding of how they all work together to help you find beauty in a life that has dealt you a really hard blow. And so I just really want to congratulate you again, Sarah. And I want to thank you so much for being a guest on our podcast. And I do hope that our listeners have picked up on how you've thought about trying to work on making yourself feel better in times where it's just been really tough. Because this is a tough disease. People are invisible. They don't feel heard. They do struggle with not finding a doctor that understands. But you've kept going. And I would encourage all of our listeners to take something out of the lessons that we've learned today. So, Sarah Vizer, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you so much, Anne. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So today's podcast is part of an Emerge Australia series that records interviews with patients and people of influence to ensure that the voices of those with ME/CFS are seen and heard. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by over 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID. Tune in again for our next interview, and don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au and look up Sarah's website and see if you can access Too Tired to Think, a really great resource for anybody who's able to take the time to read it at your own pace regarding how to cope with ME/CFS. Thank you again, Sarah. And
you may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday join us, and the world will live as one.